This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Terminal Experiment by Robert J. Sawyer, narrated by Paul Hecht.
Chapter 26. In theory, 9 o'clock was official starting time at DUAP Advertising. In practice, that meant that a little after 9, people began thinking about actually getting down to work. As usual, Kathy Hobson arrived around 8:50, but instead of the standard joking around as people sipped their coffee, today everything seemed somber. She moved through the open-plan office to her cubicle and saw that Shannon, the woman who worked next to her, had been crying. "What's wrong?" said Kathy. Shannon looked up, her eyes red. She sniffled.
"Did you hear about Hans?"
Kathy shook her head.
"He's dead," said Shannon and began crying again.
Jonas, the one Kathy's husband called the pseudo-intellectual, was passing by. "What happened?" asked Kathy. Jonas ran a hand through his greasy hair. "Hans was murdered."
"Murdered?"
"Uh-huh. An intruder, it seems." Toby Bailey moved closer, apparently sensing that this cluster of workers was the interesting one to be with. Someone hadn't yet heard the story. "That's right," he said. "You know he didn't show up for work yesterday? Well, Nancy Caulfield got a call late last night from his, I was going to say wife, but I guess the word is widow now. Anyway, it was in this morning's Sun as well. Service is on Thursday. Everybody gets time off to go, if they want."
"Was it robbery?" asked Kathy.
Jonas shook his head. "The newspaper said the cops had ruled out robbery as a motive. Nothing taken, apparently. And," Jonas's face showed an uncharacteristic degree of animation, "according to unnamed sources, the body was mutilated."
"Oh, God," said Kathy, stunned. "How?"
"Well, the police are refusing to comment on the mutilation." Jonas adopted that knowing air that irritated Peter so. "Even if they were willing to speak about it, I suspect they'd keep the details secret so that they could weed out any false confessions."
Kathy shook her head.
"Mutilated," she said again, the word sounding foreign to her. Ambrotus, the immortal simulacrum, dreamed. Peter walked. There was something unusual about his footfalls, though. They were softened somehow. Not like walking on grass or mud, more like the rubberized surface of a tennis court, just a hint of give as each foot came down in turn, an ever so slight springiness added to his step. He glanced down. The surface was light blue. He looked around. The material he was on was gently curved, falling away in all directions. There was no sky, just a void, a nothingness, a colorless emptiness, an absence of anything. He continued to walk slowly across the slightly resilient, curving surface. Suddenly he caught sight of Kathy in the distance, waving at him. She was wearing her old navy blue University of Toronto jacket. Spelled out on one sleeve was 9T5, her graduating year. On the other, CHEM. Peter saw now that this wasn't the Kathy of today, but rather Kathy as he'd first known her, younger, her heart-shaped face free of lines, her ebony hair halfway down her back. Peter looked down again. He had on stone-washed blue jeans, the kind of clothes he hadn't worn for 20 years. He began to walk toward her, and she toward him. With each step her clothes and hairstyle changed, and after every dozen paces or so it was clear that she had aged a little more. Peter felt a beard erupting from his face and then disappearing. A bad experiment abandoned. And, as he walked further, he felt a coolness on the top of his head as he began to lose his hair. But, after a few more paces, Peter realized that all changes in him, at least, had stopped. His hair thinned no farther. His body did not hunch over. His joints continued to work with ease and smoothness. They walked and walked. But soon, Peter realized that they weren't getting closer to each other. Indeed, they were growing farther and farther apart. The ground between them was expanding. The rubbery blueness was growing bigger and bigger. Peter began to run, and so did Kathy, but it did no good. They were on the surface of a great balloon that was inflating.
With each passing moment, its surface area increased and the distance between them grew. An expanding universe. A universe of vast time. Even though she was far away now, Peter could still perceive the details of Kathy's face, the lines around her eyes. Soon she gave up running, gave up even walking. She just stood there, on the ever-growing surface. She continued to wave, but Peter understood that it had become a wave of goodbye. No immortality for her. The surface continued to expand, and soon she had slipped over the horizon, out of sight. When Kathy got home that evening, she told Peter. Together they watched the City Pulse news at 6, but the report added very little to what she'd learned at work. Still, Peter was surprised to see how small a house Hans had had, a pleasing reminder that at least in economic matters, Peter had been his better by an order of magnitude. Kathy seemed to still be in shock, dazed by the news. Peter shocked himself by how satisfactory all this seemed. But it irritated him to see her mourning the death. Granted, she and Hans had worked together for years, still there was something deep in Peter that was affronted by her sadness. Even though he had to get up early for a meeting, some Japanese journalists were flying in to interview him about the soul wave, he didn't even make a pretense of trying to go to bed at the same time as Kathy. Instead, he stayed up, watched white-haired Jay Leno for a bit, then ambled off to his office and dialed into Mirror Image. He received the same menu as before. F1, Spirit, Life After Death. F2, Ambrotos, Immortality. F3, Control, Unmodified. Once again, he selected the control sim. "Hello," said Peter. "It's me, Peter." "Hello," replied the sim. "It's after midnight. Shouldn't you be in bed?" Peter nodded. "I suppose. I don't know. I guess I'm jealous in a funny sort of way." "Jealous?" "Of Hans. He was killed yesterday morning."
"Was he? My God!"
"You sound like Kath, all fucking choked up."
"Well, it does come as a surprise."
"I suppose," said Peter. "Still?"
"Still what?"
"Still, it bothers me that she's so upset by this. Sometimes," he paused for a long time, "then, sometimes, I wonder if I married the right woman." The sim's voice was neutral. "You didn't have much choice."
"Oh, I don't know," said Peter. "There was Becky. Becky and I would have been wonderful together."
The speaker made a very strange sound, perhaps the electronic equivalent of blowing a raspberry. "People think the choice of who they marry is a big decision and a very personal reflection of who they are. It's not. Not really."
"Of course it is," said Peter.
"No, it's not. Look, I've got nothing much to do these days except read stuff coming in off the net. One thing I've been looking into is twin studies. I guess kind of being your silicon twin has got me interested."
"Gallium arsenide," said Peter.
The raspberry sounded again. "The studies show that twins separated at birth are enormously alike in thousands of ways. They have the same favorite chocolate bar. They like the same music. If male, they both choose to grow or not to grow a beard. They end up with similar careers. On and on, similarity after similarity, except in one thing. Spouses. One twin may have an athletic spouse, the other a delicate intellectual, one a blonde, the other a brunette, one an extrovert, the other a wallflower."
"Really?"
said Peter.
"Absolutely," said Control.
"Twin studies are devastating to the ego. All those similarities in tastes show that nature, not nurture, is the overwhelming component of personality. In fact, I read a great study today about two twins separated at birth. Both were slobs. One had adoptive parents who were obsessive about neatness. The other was adopted by a family with a messy household. A researcher asked the twins why they were sloppy, and both said it was a reaction to their adoptive parents. One said, 'My mother was such a neat freak, I can't bear to be so meticulous,' but the other said, 'Well, gee, my mother was a slob, so I guess I picked it up from her.' In fact, neither answer is true. Being messy was in their genes. Almost everything we are is in our genes." Peter digested this. But doesn't the choice of radically different spouses refute that? Doesn't that prove we are individuals shaped by our individual upbringings?
At first glance, it might seem that way, said Control, but in fact it proves exactly the opposite. Think about when we got engaged to Kathy. We were 28, just about to finish our doctorate. We were ready to get on with life. We wanted to get married. Granted, we were already very much in love with Kathy, but even if we weren't, we'd probably have wanted to get married about then. If she hadn't been there, we would have looked around at our circle of acquaintances to find a mate. But think about it. We really had very few possibilities. First, eliminate all those who were already married or engaged. Becky was engaged to somebody else at that point, for instance. Then, eliminate all those who weren't approximately our same age. Then, to be really honest with ourselves, eliminate those of other races or profoundly different religions. Who would have been left? One person? Maybe two? Maybe if we'd been extraordinarily lucky, three or four, but that's it. You're fantasizing about all the people we could have married, but if you look at it, really look at it, you'll find we had almost no choice at all.
Peter shook his head. It seems so cold and impersonal when put like that.
In a lot of ways, it is, said the Sim, but it's given me a new appreciation for Sarkar and Rahima's arranged marriage. I'd always thought that was wrong, but when you get right down to it, the difference is trivial. They didn't have much choice in who they married, and neither did we.
I suppose, said Peter.
It's true, said the Sim. So go to bed already. Go upstairs and lie down next to your wife. He paused. I should be so lucky myself.
Chapter 27 Detective Inspector Alexandria Philo had a love-hate relationship with this part of her job. On the one hand, questioning those who had known the deceased often provided valuable clues, but on the other, having to pump distraught people for information was an unpleasant experience all around. Even worse was the cynicism that went with the process. Not everyone would be telling the truth. Some of the tears would be crocodile. Sandra's natural instinct was to offer sympathy for those who were in pain, but the cop in her said that nothing should be taken at face value. No, she thought, it wasn't the cop in her that made her say that, it was the civilian. Once her marriage to Walter was over, all the people who had earlier congratulated her on their engagement and wedding started saying things like, "Oh, I knew it would never last," and, "Gee, he really wasn't right for you, and he was an ape, or a Neanderthal, or a jerk," or whatever the individual's favorite metaphor for stupid people was. Sandra had learned, then, that people, even good people, even your friends, will lie to you. At any given moment, they will tell you what they think you want to hear. The elevator door slid open on the 16th floor of the North American Life Tower. Sandra stepped out. Duap Advertising had its own lobby, all in chrome and pink leather, directly off the elevators. Sandra walked over to stand in front of the receptionist's large desk. These days, most companies had gotten rid of the fluffy bimbos at the front desk and replaced them with more mature adults of either sex, projecting a more businesslike image. But advertising was still advertising, and sex still sold. Sandra tried to keep a conversation to words of one syllable for the benefit of the pretty young thing behind the desk. After flashing her badge at a few executives, Sandra arranged to interview each of the employees. Duap used the kind of open office floor plan that had become popular in the 80s. Everyone had a cubicle in the center of the room, delineated by movable room dividers covered in gray fabric. Around the outside of the room were offices, but they belonged to no particular person, and no one was allowed to homestead in one. Instead, they were used as needed for client consultations, private meetings, and so on. And now it was only a matter of listening. Sandra knew that Joe Friday had been an idiot. Just the facts, ma'am, got you nowhere at all. People were uncomfortable about giving facts, especially to the police. But opinions? Everybody loved to have their opinion solicited. Sandra had found a sympathetic ear was much more effective than a world-weary get-to-the-point approach. Besides, being a good listener was the best way of finding the office gossip, that one person who knew everything and had no compunctions about sharing it. At Duap Advertising, that person turned out to be Toby Bailey.
"You see 'em come and go in this business,"
said Toby, spreading his arms to demonstrate how the advertising trade encompassed all of reality. The creative types are the worst, of course. They're all neurotic. But they're only a tiny part of the process. Me, I'm a media buyer. I acquire space for ads. That's where the real power is.
Sandra nodded encouragingly. It sounds like a fascinating business.
Oh, it's like everything else, said Toby. Having now established the wonders of advertising, he was prepared to be magnanimous. It takes all kinds. Take poor old Hans, for instance. Now, he was a real character. Loved the ladies. Not that his wife was hard to look at, but Hans, well, he was interested in quantity, not quality.
Toby smiled, inviting Sandra to react to his joke. Sandra did just that, chuckling politely.
So he just wanted to put more notches on his belt, so that was the only thing that mattered to him?
Toby raised a hand, as if fearing that his words might be construed as speaking ill of the dead.
Oh, no, he only liked pretty women. You never saw him with anything below an 8.
An 8, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, looks-wise?
Pig, thought Sandra. I imagine in an advertising firm you must have a lot of pretty women.
Oh, yes, packaging sells, if you'll forgive me for saying so. He seemed to be mentally thumbing through the company's personnel files.
Oh, yes, he said again. I noticed your receptionist when I came in.
Megan, said Toby. Case in point. Hans set his sights on her the moment she was hired. It didn't take long for her to fall for his charms.
Sandra glanced at the personnel roster she'd been given. Megan Mulvaney.
Still, said Sandra, did Hans have any particular likes or dislikes when it came to women? I mean, pretty is a broad category.
Toby opened his mouth as if to say something stupid like, so to speak. Sandra gave him points for stopping himself before he did so, but he did seem quite animated, as if talking about beautiful women to a woman was in itself a turn-on.
Well, he liked them to be, well-endowed, if you catch my meaning, and I don't know, I suppose his taste was a little more toward the sultry than my own. Still, almost anyone was fair game. I mean, one would hardly call Kathy or Tony sultry, although they're both quite attractive.
Sandra stole another glance at the roster. Kathy Hobson, Tony D'Ambrosio. More starting points. She smiled.
Still, she said, a lot of men are all talk and no action. A number of people have mentioned Hans's prowess, but tell me truthfully, Toby, was he all he was cracked up to be?
Oh, yes, said Toby, feeling the need now to defend his dead friend. If he went after somebody, he got her. I never saw him fail.
I see, said Sandra.
What about Hans's boss?
Nancy Caulfield, now there's a character. Let me tell you how Hans finally got her.
For Spirit, the life-after-death sim, there was no such thing anymore as biological sleep. No distinction between consciousness and unconsciousness. For a flesh-and-blood person, dreams provided a different perspective, a second opinion about the day's events. But Spirit had only one mode, only one way of looking at the universe. Still, he sought connections. Kathy, his wife, once upon a time. He remembered that she had been beautiful, to him at least. But now, freed from biological urges, the memory of her face, her figure, excited no aesthetic response. Kathy. In lieu of dreaming, Spirit cogitated idly. Kathy. Is that an anagram for anything?
No, of course not.
Oh, wait a moment. Yacht. Fancy that. He'd never thought of that before.
Yachts had pleasing lines, a certain mathematical perfection dictated by the laws of fluid dynamics. Their beauty, at least, was something he could still appreciate.
Kathy had done something, something wrong, something that had hurt him. He remembered what it was, of course. Remembered the hurt the same way, if he cared to, that he could summon the memories of other pains. Breaking his leg skiing, a skinned knee in childhood. Bumping his head for the dozenth time on that low ceiling beam at Kathy's parents' cottage. Memories. But finally, at last, no more pain. No pain sensor. Sensor. an anagram of snores, something I don't do any more. Dreams had been great for making connections. Spirit was going to miss dreaming.
Chapter 28. Even though Toby Bailey had given her some good leads, Sandra continued to work her way alphabetically down the roster of DUAP employees. Finally, it was Kathy Hobson's turn, one of those Bailey had mentioned Hans had been involved with. Sandra sized up Kathy as she seated herself. Pretty woman, thin, with lots of black hair, good dresser. Sandra smiled.
Miss Hobson, thank you for your time. I won't keep you long. I just want to ask a few questions about Hans Larsen.
Kathy nodded.
How well did you know him? Sandra asked.
Kathy looked past Sandra at the wall behind her.
Not very.
No point in confronting her just yet.
Sandra glanced at a printout.
He'd worked here longer than you had. I'd be interested in anything you could tell me. What sort of a man was he?
Kathy looked at the ceiling.
Very outgoing.
Yes.
And, well, a somewhat crude sense of humor.
Sandra nodded.
Somebody else mentioned that, too. He told a lot of dirty jokes. Did that bother you, Miss Hobson?
Me?
Kathy looked surprised and met Sandra's eyes for the first time.
No.
What else can you tell me?
He was good at his job, from what I understand. His end and mine didn't intersect very often.
What else?
Sandra smiled encouragingly. Anything at all might be useful.
Well, he was married. I assume you knew that. His wife's name was, Donna Lee, said Sandra.
Yes, that was it.
A nice lady, is she?
She's all right, said Kathy. Very pretty, but I only met her a couple of times.
She came by the office, then?
No, not that I can recall.
Then where did you meet her?
Oh, sometimes the gang from here would go out for a drink.
Sandra consulted her notes.
Every Friday, she said, or so I've been told.
Yes, that's right. Sometimes his wife would show up for a bit.
Sandra watched her carefully.
So you did socialize with Hans, then, Miss Hobson?
Kathy lifted a hand.
Only as part of a group. Sometimes we would get a bunch of tickets to a Blue Jays game, too, and go down for that. You know, tickets given to the company by suppliers?
She covered her mouth.
Oh, that's not illegal, is it?
Not as far as I know, said Sandra, smiling again.
Not really my department. When you saw Hans and his wife together, did they seem happy?
I can't really say. I suppose so. I mean, who can tell, looking at a marriage from the outside, what's really going on?
Sandra nodded. Ain't that the truth?
She seemed happy enough.
Who?
You know, Hans's wife.
Whose name is...
Kathy looked confused.
Why, Donna Lee.
Donna Lee, yes.
You said it earlier,
said Kathy, a bit defensively.
Oh, yes, so I did.
Sandra tapped the cursor keys on her palm-top computer, consulting her list of questions.
On another matter, a couple of the other people I've interviewed here said that Hans had a bit of a reputation as a ladies' man.
Kathy said nothing.
Is that true, Mrs. Hobson?
For the first time, Sandra had said Mrs., not Ms.
Well, yes, I suppose it is.
Someone told me he had slept with a number of the women here at this company. Had you heard similar things about him?
Kathy picked some invisible lint off her skirt.
I guess so.
But you didn't feel it worth mentioning.
I didn't want...
She trailed off.
Didn't want to speak ill of the dead, of course, of course. Sandra smiled warmly. Forgive me for asking this, but, did you ever have a relationship with him?
Kathy looked up.
Certainly not. I'm a married woman, said Sandra.
Of course.
She smiled again. I do apologize for having to ask.
Kathy opened her mouth to object further, then after a moment closed it. Sandra recognized the drama playing over Kathy's face.
The lady doth protest too much, methinks.
Do you know of anyone he did have a relationship with? Asked Sandra.
Not for certain. Surely if he had that reputation, word must have gotten around.
There have been rumors, but I don't believe in repeating gossip, Inspector, and— Kathy rallied some strength here. I don't believe you have the authority to compel me to do so.
Sandra nodded, as if this was completely reasonable. She closed the lid on her palm top.
Thank you for your candor, she said, her tone so neutral as to make characterizing the remark as either sincere or sarcastic impossible.
Just one more question. Again, I apologize, but I have to ask this. Where were you on November 14th between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m.? That's when Hans died.
Kathy tilted her head. Let's see, that was the day before we all heard about it. Well, I would have been on my way to work, of course. In fact, now that you mention it, that would have been the day I picked up Carla and gave her a lift to where she works.
Carla? Who's that?
Carla Wyszynski, a friend of mine. She lives a couple of blocks from where Peter and I do. Her car was in the shop, so I agreed to give her a lift.
I see.
Well, thank you very much, Miss Hobson. She glanced down the list of names. When you go back out, could you ask Mr. Stephen Jessup to come in, please?
Chapter 29. Getting rid of Hans Larsen had been easy. After all, why worry about covering one's tracks? Yes, the police would certainly investigate the crime, but they'd soon find that there were dozens of people who might have wanted to see the philandering Hans dead in the same poetic justice fashion. For the second elimination, though, the Sim knew he would have to be more subtle. Something untraceable was called for, something that didn't even look like murder. With healthcare costs spiraling ever upward, most developed countries were turning toward inexpensive prevention rather than catastrophic treatment. That required identifying risks particular to each patient, and for that a detailed knowledge of family history was invaluable. But originally, not everyone had had access to such information. In 2004, a group of adults who had been adopted as children successfully lobbied Canada's provincial and federal governments to establish the Nationwide Confidential Medical Records Database, or MedBase. The rationale was simple. All health records should be centralized so that any doctor could access information with the names removed to protect privacy about relatives of any of their patients, even if, as was frequently true in the case of adoption, the individuals in question didn't know they were related. The Sim had to try more than 20 times, but it did eventually manage to find a way into MedBase and from there a roundabout way to get the information it wanted. Log in, J. DeSalle. Password, Ella said. Welcome, bienvenue, Health and Welfare Canada, Santé et Bien-être Social Canada, MedBase. 1 for English, 2 pour Français. 1. Enter patient's province or territory of residence, L for list, Ontario. Enter patient's name or health card number, 331834-22149. Hobson, Catherine R., correct? Yes or no?
Yes.
What would you like to do? 1. Display patient's record. 2. Search patient's family history. 2. Search for H for help. The Sim selected H, read the help screens, then formulated this query. Familial risk. Heart disease. There was a pause while the system searched. Correlations found. The computer proceeded to list records for 6 different relatives of Kathy who had had heart problems over the years. Although no names were given, the Sim had no trouble figuring out which one belonged to Rod Churchill based on the age at which the coronary trouble had first occurred. The Sim asked for the full record for that patient. The computer provided it again without listing the patient's name. He studied the medical history minutely. Rod was currently taking heart medication and something called phenylzine. The Sim logged onto Medline, a general medical information database, and began searching the literature for information on those drugs. It took some digging, and the Sim had to access an online medical dictionary continually to be able to wade through it all, but at last he had what he wanted. Finally, the long day of interviews at Duap Advertising was over.
Detective Sandra Philo drove slowly back to her empty apartment. On the way, she took advantage of the car's phone to check a few things.
"Carla Wyszynski?" she said into the dashboard mic.
"Yes," said the voice through the speaker. "This is Inspector Alexandria Philo of the Metro Police. I've got a quick question for you."
Wyszynski sounded flustered.
Yes, of course. "Were you by any chance with Catherine Hobson on the morning of November 10th?
"With Kathy, let me bring up my scheduler," the sound of key clicks.
"On the 10th, no, I'm afraid not. Is she in some kind of trouble?"
Sandra turned the car onto Lawrence West.
"Did I say the 10th?" she said. "My mistake, I meant the 14th.
"Oh, I don't think—"
More key clicks. "Oh, wait, that's the day my car was in for service. Yes, Kathy picked me up and took me to work. She's a sweetheart about things like that."
"Thank you," said Sandra. It was a standard technique. First determine that the person won't issue a reflex lie to protect her friend, then ask the real question. Kathy Hobson apparently had a valid alibi. Still, if it had been a professional hit, the fact that she'd been somewhere else when the deed was done proved little.
"Is there anything else?" asked Carla Wyszynski.
"No, that's all. Were you planning on leaving town?"
"Yes, I'm going to Spain on vacation."
"Well then, have a nice trip," said Sandra. She never tired of doing that.
Spirit, the life-after-death sim, probed the net, looking for new stimulation. Everything was so static, so unchanging. Oh, he could absorb a book or a newsgroup quickly, but the information itself was passive, and ultimately that made it boring. Spirit also wandered through the computers at Mirror Image. Eventually he found Sarker's game bank and tried playing chess and Tetris and Go and Bollocks and a thousand others, but they were no better than the interactive games on the net. Peter Hobson had never really liked games anyway. He much preferred devoting his energies to things that actually made a difference, rather than to silly contests that in the end changed nothing. Spirit continued to search, going through file after file. And at last he came upon a subdirectory called A-Life. Here blue fish were evolving, the ones judged most fit getting to breed. Spirit watched several generations go by, fascinated by the process. Life, he thought. Life. Finally, Spirit had found something that intrigued him. Chapter 30. Enough time had elapsed, Sarker felt, for the Sims to have adapted to their new circumstances. It was time to start posing the big questions. Sarker and Peter were both tied up with other things for the next couple of days, but finally they got together at Mirror Image and ensconced themselves in the computer lab. Sarker brought Umbratos into the foreground. He was about to begin asking it questions, but thought better of it.
"It's your mind," Sarker said. "You should ask the questions."
Peter nodded and cleared his throat.
"Hello, Umbratos," he said.
"Hello, Peter," said that mechanical voice.
"What is immortality really like?"
Umbratos took a long time before replying, as if contemplating all of eternity first.
"It's relaxing, I suppose, is the best word for it."
Another pause. Nothing was rushed.
"I hadn't realized how much pressure aging put on us.
Oh, I know women sometimes say their biological clock is ticking, but there's a bigger clock affecting all of us. At least people like you and me, driven people, people with a need to accomplish things. We know we've only got a limited amount of time, and there's so much we want to get done. We curse every wasted minute."
Another pause.
"Well, I don't feel that anymore. I don't feel the pressure to do things quickly. I still want to accomplish things, but there'll always be tomorrow. There'll always be more time."
Peter considered. "I'm not sure I'd consider being less driven an improvement. I like getting things done." Umbratos's reply was infinitely calm.
"And I like relaxing. I like knowing that if I want to spend 3 weeks or 3 years learning about something that strikes my fancy, that I can, without it somehow reducing my productive time.
If I feel like reading a novel today instead of working on some project, what's wrong with that?
But, said Peter, you know as I do now that there's some form of life after death. Don't you wonder about that?
The Sim laughed. You and I never believed in life after death. Even now, even knowing that, yes, something does survive the physical demise of the body, I'm not attracted to whatever afterlife there might be. Clearly, it would be beyond physical existence. It would involve the intellect, but not the body. I never thought of myself as a sensualist, and we both know we're not very athletic, but I like sex. I like feeling sun on my skin. I like eating a really good meal. I even like eating lousy meals. I'd miss my body if it wasn't there. I'd miss physical stimulation. I'd miss everything. Gooseflesh, and being tickled, and cutting a really good fart, and running my hand over my 5 o'clock shadow. All of it. Sure, life after death might be forever, but so is physical immortality, and I like the physical part.
Peter was guarded. Sarka was listening intently.
What about our relationship with Kathy? I guess you think the whole marriage is just a tiny blip in a vast life.
Oh, no, said Ambrotos. Funny, despite that crack Colin Godoyo made, I'd thought that an immortal would rue the day he'd sworn to do anything until death do us part. But I don't feel that way at all. In fact, this has added a whole new dimension to marriage. If Kathy becomes immortal, too, there's a chance, a real chance, that I may finally, actually, completely get to know her. In the 15 years we've been living together, I've already gotten to know her better than any other human being. I know what sort of risque jokes will make her giggle, and what kind will turn her right off. I know how important her ceramics are to her. I know that she's not really serious when she says she doesn't like horror films, but that she is absolutely serious when she says she doesn't like 1950s rock music. And I know how bright she is, brighter than me in a lot of ways. After all, I've never been able to do the New York Times crossword. But despite all that, I still know only the tiniest fraction of her. Surely she's every bit as complex as I am. What does she really think about my parents? About her sister? Does she ever silently pray? Does she really enjoy some of the things we do together, or just tolerate them? What thoughts does she have that even after all this time she still doesn't yet feel comfortable enough to share with me? Sure, we exchange little bits of ourselves every time we interact, but as the decades and centuries go by, we'll get to know each other better. And nothing pleases me more than that.
Peter frowned. But people change. You can't take 1,000 years to get to know an individual any more than you can take 1,000 years to get to know a city. Once all that time has elapsed, the old information will be completely obsolete.
And that's the most wonderful thing of all, said the Sim, not pausing at all this time. I could spend forever with Kathy and never run out of new things to learn about her.
Peter leaned back in his chair, thinking. Sarka took the opportunity for a turn at the mic.
But isn't immortality boring?
The Sim laughed.
Forgive me, my friend, but that's one of the silliest ideas I've ever heard.
Boring? When you've got the totality of creation to comprehend? I've never read a play by Aristophanes. I've never studied any Asian language. I don't understand anything about ballet or lacrosse or meteorology. I can't read music. I can't play the drums.
Laughter again. I want to write a novel and a sonnet and a song. Yes, they'll all stink, but eventually I'll learn to do them well. I want to learn to paint and to appreciate opera and to really understand quantum physics. I want to read all the great books and all the trashy ones, too. I want to learn about Buddhism and Judaism and Seventh-day Adventists. I want to visit Australia and Japan and the Galapagos. I want to go into space. I want to go to the bottom of the ocean. I want to learn it all, do it all, live it all. Immortality? Boring? Impossible. Even the lifetime of the universe may not be enough to do all the things I want to do. Peter and Sarka were interrupted by a call from Sarka's receptionist. "Excuse me," said the little Asian man from the screen of the videophone, "but there's a long-distance video call for Dr. Hobson." Peter lifted his eyebrows. Sarka motioned for him to have a seat in front of the phone. "I'm here, Chin." "Patching through," he said. The screen image changed to show a middle-aged, red-haired woman, Brenda McTavish, from the Glasgow Chimpanzee Retirement Home. "Ah, Peter," she said. "I called your office, and they said you'd be here." "Hi, Brenda," Peter said. He peered at the screen. Had she been crying? "Forgive the state I'm in," she said. "We just lost Cornelius, one of our oldest residents. He had a heart attack. Chimps normally don't get those, but he'd been used for years in smoking research." She shook her head in wonder at the cruelty. "When we first spoke, of course, I didn't know what you were up to. Now I've seen you all over the telly and read all about it in The Economist. Anyway, we got the recordings you wanted. I'm sending the data over the net tonight." "Did you look at it?" said Peter. "Aye," she said. "Chimps have souls." Her voice was bitter as she thought about her lost friend. As if anyone could have ever doubted that. The Sim's first thought was to tamper with the prescription database at Shoppers Drug Mart, the pharmacy chain used by Rod Churchill. But despite repeated attempts, he couldn't get in. It was frustrating, but not surprising. Of course, a drugstore would have a very high security, but there was more than one way to skin a gym teacher, and there were lots of low-security computer systems around. Since the 1970s, immigration officials at Toronto's Pearson International Airport had used a simple test whenever someone arrived claiming to be a Torontonian, but whose papers weren't entirely in order. They asked the person what the phone number was of a famous local pizza delivery chain. No one could live in Toronto and not know that number. It appeared on billboards, countless newspaper and TV ads, and was sung incessantly as a jingle in radio commercials. As the decades passed, the chain widened its array of deliverable meals, first adding other Italian dishes, then submarine sandwiches, then barbecued chicken and ribs, then burgers, and eventually a whole range of cuisine, from the pedestrian to the exotic. Although they'd kept their trademark phone number, they eventually changed their name to Food Food. But even back in its humble pizza days, the company prided itself on its state-of-the-art computerized ordering system. All orders were placed through the one central phone number and then transferred to the whichever of the over 300 stores throughout Metro Toronto was closest to the caller's home, allowing the food to be delivered within 30 minutes, or the customer got it for free. Well, Rod Churchill had said that every Wednesday night when his wife was out at a conversational French course, he ordered dinner from Food Food. The chain's computer records would have a complete history of every meal he'd ever ordered from there. Food Food was famous for being able to not just give you the same order you had last time, but also, if you wanted it, a repeat of what you'd had on any occasion in the past. It took a couple of days of trying, but the Sim eventually unraveled the security of Food Food's computers. As he expected, the safety precautions were much less rigid than those of a drugstore. He called up Rod's ordering history. Perfect. Like all restaurants, Food Food was obligated to provide full ingredient and nutritional information, which could be read by videophone at the customer's leisure. The Sim waded carefully through it until he found exactly what he was looking for. Net News Digest. Pope Benedict XVI today released an encyclical affirming the existence of an immortal divine soul within human beings. The pontiff revealed that the Papal Committee on Science was now in the process of evaluating the evidence related to the discovery of the soul wave. Unconfirmed reports indicate that the Vatican has placed an order with Hobson Monitoring Limited for 3 soul detector units. Charity News. The United Way of Metropolitan Toronto reported a record-breaking week of donations. The American Red Cross announced today that more units of blood had been collected in the past 10 days than at any comparable period since the Great California Quake.
The Aid Society of Iowa is delighted to announce the receipt of a $10 million anonymous contribution, and televangelist Gus Honeywell, whose own direct broadcast satellite ensures worldwide coverage for his programs, today doubled the donation required to join his God's Inner Circle from $50,000 to $100,000. In 1954, an American physician named Moses Kennelly left a $50,000 trust fund for anyone who could prove the existence of some sort of life after death. The fund has been administered for 57 years now by the Connecticut Parapsychic Society, which announced today that the fund, currently worth $1,077,543, will be awarded to Peter G. Hobson of Toronto, discoverer of the soul wave. The Ultimate Memorial, Davidson's Funeral Homes, now offers deathbed recordings of the departing soul. Call for details. Representative Paul Christmas, Republican of Iowa, today introduced a bill in the U.S. House of Representatives that would require hospitals to terminate life support for patients with no realistic hope of recovering consciousness. "We're interfering in God's attempt to bring these poor souls back home," he said.
Chapter 31. Peter made a couple of phone calls to pass on the news from Glasgow, then rejoined Sarker at the main console. Sarker moved the Ambrotos simulacrum into the background and brought Spirit, the life-after-death sim, into the foreground. Peter leaned into the mic.
"I'd like to ask you a question," he said.
"The big question, no doubt," said the sim.
"What's it like being dead?"
"Exactly." Spirit's voice came through the speaker.
"It's like..."
But then it trailed off. Peter leaned forward in anticipation.
"Yes? It's like being an aardvark."
Peter's jaw went a little slack.
"How can it be like being an aardvark? Or maybe an anteater," said the sim. "I can't see myself, but I know I've got a very long tongue."
"Reincarnation," said Sarker, nodding slowly. "My Hindu friends will be pleased to hear this, but I must say I'd hoped for better for you, Peter, than an aardvark."
"I'm getting hungry," said the voice from the speaker. "Anybody got any ants?"
"I don't believe this," said Peter, shaking his head.
"Ha," said the speaker. "Had you going there for a moment."
"No, you did not," said Peter.
"Well," said the synthesized voice a little petulantly, "I had Sarker going anyway."
"Not really," said Sarker.
"You're just being a pain," Peter said into the microphone.
"Like father, like son," said the sim.
"You crack a lot of jokes," said Peter.
"Death is very funny," Spirit said. "No, actually, life is very funny. Absurd, actually. It's all absurd."
"Funny," said Sarker. "I thought laughter was a biological response."
"The sound of laughter might be, although I've come to realize it's more of a social rather than a biological phenomenon. But finding something funny isn't biological. I know when Petey watches sitcoms, he hardly ever laughs out loud. That doesn't mean he's not finding them funny."
"I suppose," said Peter.
"In fact, I think I know exactly what humor is now. Humor is the response to the sudden formation of unexpected neural nets."
"I don't get it," said Peter.
"Exactly, I don't get it. People say precisely the same thing when they don't understand something serious as they do when they fail to understand a joke. We intuitively realize that some sort of connection hasn't been made, that connection is a neural net." The after-death sim continued on without any pauses. "Laughter, even if it's only laughter on the inside, which incidentally is the only side I've got these days, is the response that goes along with new connections forming in the brain, that is, with synapses firing in ways they've never, or at least rarely, fired before. When you hear a new joke, you laugh, and you might even laugh the second or third time you hear it. The neural net is not yet well established. But every joke wears thin after a while. You know the old one, 'Why did the chicken cross the road?' As an adult, we don't laugh at that, but we all did when we first heard it as children.
And the difference is not just because the joke is somehow childish, it isn't really. It's actually quite sophisticated. It's just that the neural net is now well established.
Which neural net? Asked Peter. The one connecting our ideas about poultry, which we normally think of as passive and stupid, and our ideas about self-determination and personal initiative. That's what's funny about that joke, the idea that a chicken might go across the street because it wanted to, because perhaps it was curious. That's a new idea, and the formation of the new network, interconnections of neurons that represent that idea, is what causes the momentary disruption of mental processes that we call laughter.
I'm not sure I buy that, said Peter. I'd shrug if I could. Look, I'll prove it. Know what Mr. Spock orders when he goes into the Starfleet commissary?
The sim took its first pause, a perfect comedic beat.
A Vulcan mind melt.
Pretty good, said Peter, smiling. Thank you. I just made it up, of course. I couldn't have told you a joke that we both already knew. Now, consider this. What if I'd presented the joke slightly differently by starting off with, You've heard of the Vulcan mind meld, well?
That would have ruined it.
Precisely. The part of your brain that contained thoughts about the Vulcan mind meld would have already been stimulated, and at the end there would have been no sudden connection between the normally unrelated thoughts of food items, such as a patty melt, and Vulcans. It's the new connections that cause the laughter response.
But we don't often laugh out loud when we're alone, said Sarka.
No, that's true. Social laughter serves a different purpose from internal laughter, I think. You see, unexpected connections can be amusing, but they're also disconcerting. The brain wonders if it's malfunctioning, so when others are around, it sends out a signal. And if it gets the same signal back, the brain relaxes. If it doesn't, then the brain is concerned. Maybe there is something wrong with me. That's why people are so earnest when saying, don't you get it? They desperately want to explain the joke and are actually upset if the other person doesn't find it funny. That's also why sitcoms need laugh tracks. It's not to tell us that something is funny. Rather, it's to reassure us that what we're finding funny is something that it is normal to be amused by. A laugh track doesn't make a stupid show any funnier, but it does let us enjoy a funnier show more by letting us relax.
But what's this got to do with being dead? Asked Peter.
It has everything to do with it. Seeking new connections is all that's left. Ever since puberty, I'd thought about sex every few minutes, but I no longer feel any sexual urges. And, indeed, I must say, I can't even figure out why I was so preoccupied with sex. I was also obsessed with food, always wondering what I was going to eat next, but I don't care at all about that anymore either. The only thing left for me is finding new connections. The only thing left is humor.
But some people don't have much of a sense of humor, said Sarka.
The only kind of hell I can envision, said Spirit, is going through eternity without having the rush of new connections being made, not seeing things in new ways, not being tickled by the absurdity of economics, of religion, of science, of art. It's all very, very funny if you think about it.
But what about God?
There's no God, said Spirit, at least not in the Sunday school sense. But, of course, that's not the sort of thing you have to die to find out. Given that millions of children are starving to death in Africa, and 200,000 people were killed in the Great California Quake, and everywhere there are people being tortured and raped and murdered, it's intuitively obvious that no one is looking out for us on an individual basis.
So that's all life after death is? Asked Peter. Humor?
Nothing wrong with that, said Spirit. No pain or suffering or desires, just lots of fascinating new connections. Lots of laughs.
Rod Churchill dialed the magic number and heard his phone issue the familiar melody of tones.
Thank you for calling Food Food, said the female voice at the other end of the phone. May I take your order, please?
Rod remembered the old days when Food Food and its pizzeria progenitor had always begun by asking you for your phone number, since that's how they indexed records in their database.
But with call display, the caller's record was automatically brought up on the order taker's screen the moment the phone was answered.
"Yes, please," said Rod. "I'd like the same thing I had last Wednesday night.
Roast beef, medium rare, with low-calorie gravy, baked potato, vegetable medley, and apple pie. Is that right, sir?"
"Yes," said Rod.
When he'd started ordering from them, Rod had carefully gone over Food Food's online list of ingredients, picking only items that wouldn't interfere with his medication.
"No problem, sir," said the order taker. "Will there be anything else?" "No, that's it, please. Your total is $72.50. Will that be cash or charge?" "On my Visa card, please." "Card number?"
Rod knew the woman had it on the screen in front of her, but he also knew that she had to ask for it as a security precaution. He read it out, then, predicting her next question, added the expiry date.
"Very good, sir. The time is now 6:18. Your dinner will be there in 30 minutes, or it's free. Thank you for calling Food Food."
Peter and Sarker were sitting in the lunchroom at Mirror Image. Peter was sipping Diet Coke from a can. Sarker was drinking real Coke. It was only when sharing a pitcher with Peter that he tolerated the low-calorie stuff.
"Lots of laughs," said Sarker. "What a bizarre definition of death."
A pause. "Maybe we should start calling him Brevity instead of Spirit. After all, he is now the soul of wit." Peter smiled. "Have you noticed the way he talks, though?"
"Who? Spirit?"
"Yes."
"I didn't notice anything special," said Sarker.
"He's long-winded."
"Hey, Petey, I have news for you. So are you."
Peter grinned.
"I mean, he was speaking in incredibly long sentences. Very convoluted, very complex."
"I guess I did notice that." "You had some sessions with him before this one, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Can we get a transcript of them?"
"Sure."
They took their drinks and headed back down to the lab. Sarker tapped a few keys, and the printer disgorged several dozen thin sheets. Peter glanced over the text.
"Do you have a grammar checker online?"
"Better than that, we have Proofreader, one of our expert systems."
"Can you feed this text through it?"
Sarker typed some commands into the computer. An analysis of Spirit's comments from their various sessions appeared on screen.
"Amazing," said Sarker.
He pointed to a figure. Ignoring simple interjections, Spirit averaged 32 words per sentence and in some places had gone over 300 words in a single sentence.
"Normal conversation averages only 10 or so words per sentence."
"Can this proofreader of yours do a cleanup on the transcripts?"
"Sure."
"Do it." Sarker typed some commands.
"Incredible," he said, once the results were on the screen. "There was almost nothing to fix. Spirit has even his giant sentences completely under control and never loses his train of thought."
"Fascinating," said Peter. "Could it be a programming glitch?" Sarker smoothed his hair with his hand.
"Have you noticed Control or Ambrotos doing the same thing?"
"No."
"Then offhand, I would say it's not a glitch, but rather a real byproduct of the modifications we made. Spirit is the simulation of life after death, the intellect outside of the body. I'd say this effect must be a real consequence of having cut some neural net connections related to that."
"Oh, Christ," said Peter. "Of course, that's it. For the other sims, you still simulate breathing, but Spirit doesn't have a body, so he doesn't have to pause to breathe when speaking. Breathing pauses must cause real people to express themselves in concise chunks."
"Interesting," said Sarker. "I guess if you didn't have to breathe, you could express more complex thoughts in a single go, but that wouldn't really make you any smarter. It's thinking, not speaking, that counts."
"True, but I've noticed Spirit has a tendency to be a bit obtuse."
"I've noticed that, too," said Sarker.
"So? Well, what if he isn't being obtuse at all? What if instead—gee, I don't even like saying this—what if he's simply talking over our heads? What if not just his manner of speaking, but his actual thoughts are more complex than my own?"
Sarker considered. Well, there's nothing analogous to breathing pauses in the physical brain except...
Except what?
Well, neurons only fire for so long, said Sarkar. A neural net can only stay excited for a limited period.
Surely that's a fundamental limitation of the human mind.
No, it's a fundamental limitation of the human brain. More precisely, a limitation of the electrochemical process by which the brain works. The hardware of the brain is not designed to keep any one thought intact for any period of time. You felt it, I'm sure. You come up with a brilliant idea you wish to write down, but by the time you get to a pen, you've lost it. The idea has simply decayed in your brain.
Peter lifted his eyebrows.
But spirit is operating without a brain. He's just a mind, a soul. He's pure software, working without any hardware limitations. No breathing pauses, no nets decaying before he's finished with them. He can build as long a sentence or as complex a thought as he wants.
Sarkar was shaking his head slightly in amazement.
That's how one's mind could go on forever after death, said Peter. You couldn't just do it making simple connections like chicken crossing the road jokes. You'd run out of new juxtapose A and B thoughts eventually. But spirit can juxtapose A through Z, plus alpha through omega, plus aleph through tav, until, in all those complex combinations, some new, exciting, amusing association comes up.
Incredible, said Sarkar.
It means, said Peter, that perhaps the afterlife is full of jokes, but jokes so complex and subtle and obtuse that you and I will never understand them.
He paused. At least not until after we're dead. Sarkar made a low whistle, but then his expression changed.
Speaking of being dead, I've got to get home or Rahima will kill me. I'm cooking dinner tonight.
Peter looked at the clock. Cripes, I'm late for meeting Kathy. We're going out for dinner.
Sarkar laughed.
What's so funny?
You'll get it, said Sarkar. Eventually.
Chapter 32 The Sim had been monitoring Food Food's computer, waiting for an order for the Churchill address. Finally, there it was. The same thing Rod, creature of habit that he was, had ordered for the last 6 weeks. As soon as the order appeared in the system, the Sim intercepted it, made one small modification, then let it continue on its way through the phone line to the Food Food store at Steeles and Bayview, 6 blocks from Rod Churchill's house. Peter and Kathy had taken Kathy's car down Bayview Avenue. This part, some 10 kilometers south of where her parents lived, was entirely lined with shops, boutiques, and restaurants. They'd briefly stopped in at the Sleuth of Baker Street, Toronto's mystery bookstore, and were now looking for a break in the traffic so they could cross over to the little Korean restaurant they both liked on the other side of the street. A round man, with a shock of white hair and clad in a navy blue trench coat, was walking down the sidewalk. Peter noticed him doing a double take as he passed them. He was slowly getting used to that. He'd had enough press lately that people were recognizing him on the streets. But the man didn't move on. Instead, he came toward them.
"You're Peter Hobson, aren't you?" he said. He was about 60, with little veins visible on the surface of his nose and cheeks.
"Yes," said Peter. "You the guy who discovered that soul signal?"
"Soul wave," said Peter. "We call it the soul wave. A beat, yes, that's me."
"I thought so," said the man. "But you know, unless your soul is saved, you'll go to hell."
Kathy took Peter's arm. "Come on," she said. But the man moved to block their way.
"Give yourself over to Jesus, Mr. Hobson. It's the only way."
"I'm really not interested in discussing this," said Peter.
"Jesus forgives you," said the man.
He reached into the pocket of his trench coat. For one horrible moment, Peter thought the man was going for a gun, but instead he brought out a worn Bible bound in blood-red leather.
"Hear the word of God, Mr. Hobson. Save your soul."
Kathy spoke directly to the man.
"Leave us alone.
I can't let you go," said the man. He reached out an arm and connected with Kathy's shoulder.
Before Peter could react, Kathy had brought her shoe down on the man's instep. He yowled in pain. "Get lost!" shouted Kathy, and she firmly took Peter's arm and propelled them both across the street.
"Hey," said Peter, still flustered, but nonetheless impressed. "Pretty good."
Kathy tossed her black hair back. "No one messes with my husband," she said, grinning her megawatt grin. She led them the few doors down to the restaurant. "Now, let me buy you dinner." The doorbell rang. Rod Churchill glanced at his watch. 26 minutes. He'd yet to get a free meal, although a history teacher at his high school said she'd gotten lucky twice in a row. Out of habit, Rod glanced at the security camera display on his TV. Yep, a food driver, all right. The orange and white uniform was quite distinctive. Rod walked down to the entryway, checked himself in the hall mirror to make sure his hair was still properly combed over his bald head, and opened the door. He signed the receipt for the driver, who gave him one coffee, then took his packaged food up to the dining room. Rod opened the Envirofoam containers carefully, got himself a glass of white wine, put on the TV, easily visible from his place at the dining room table, and sat down to enjoy his meal. The roast beef was adequate, if a bit stringy, Rod thought, but the gravy was particularly good tonight. He cleaned the serving dish, using forkfuls of mashed potatoes to sop up the last of the gravy. He was halfway through his slice of pie when the pain began, a severe pounding at the back of his head, and an excruciating sensation as though spikes were being driven into his eyes. He felt his heart fluttering. His forehead was slick with sweat, and he thought for a moment he was going to vomit. A hot flash came over him. He rose to his feet, in hopes of getting to the telephone and calling for help. But suddenly there was a moment of unbearable pain, and he toppled backward, knocking his chair over, and fell to the carpeted floor, stone-cold dead. Peter and Kathy had already gone to bed, but their Hobson monitor knew that neither of them was yet asleep, and so it allowed the phone to ring. There was no video phone in the bedroom, of course. In the darkness, Peter groped for the audio handset on his night table.